Hello and welcome to Season 14, Episode 24 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this show, we're going to be talking to Reese about the Ubuntu community. We'll also have some command line love and go over your feedback. If you like what you hear and you'd like to help us continue sounding brilliant, why don't you head over to ubuntupodcast.org/donate, where you can find out how to contribute to our Patreon, or if you just want to make a one-off contribution to our production costs, you can do that via PayPal over there. And in the meantime, this week I'm joined by Alan.
Hello.
And Reese.
Hello.
Hi, Reese. Thanks for joining us again. Martin's still on hiatus, holidays, gallivanting leave, whatever you want to call it.
Hiatus? Is that one of the Greek islands?
He's frolicking on a Greek island.
Sounds lovely. Anyway, yes. Reese, what have you been up to since last we spoke?
Since last we spoke? Well, I have been being your eyes.
My eyes specifically?
Not quite your eyes, I don't think. Well, unless you haven't told me. But I've been using a little application on my mobile phone called Be Your Eyes. Be My Eyes. I've already forgotten what it's called.
Be My Eyes.
Be My Eyes. That's what it is. Yeah. It's this lovely little application. I heard about it from little Alan here, where you put it on your phone, you sign up, it gives you a little tutorial video, and then hard of sight people sort of ping you when they want to see things and they can't quite get the colors right, or they're not seeing things quite right and they want to check and see. You get a little notification on your phone, a little video stream comes to you, and you see what they want to do, and they say, hey, what's this thing, or is this red, which one's the yellow one? And it's a lot of fun.
Ah, neat.
I recently blogged about this, and I blogged about the fact that it was my favorite app that I've never used, or almost never used. I've used it once in the entire time I've had it on my phone for years, because the little notification comes in and somebody beats me to it, and I don't get to it in time. So how many occasions have you had to use the thing?
Well, then I wonder if it's a sort of a geolocation thing, because I'm in London and I've had it last week. I had two separate pings before that, since I got it, which was maybe a month ago. I had two more before that. So I've had four total since downloading it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Huh. And what have people been asking you to do? Just like literally ask you the color of something, or?
The latest one was the color of a dress.
Huh.
I was like, yep, that's the yellow one. And another one was, I think it was some text on a thing, and they wanted to make sure that they were reading it right. It must have been an important document or something.
Wow. Love it.
Yeah. Cool. And that's, you can just download that on your favorite app store.
Definitely mobile app store. I'm not sure about other app stores.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a really, really lovely little interface. It walks you through a little tutorial so you know what you're doing. And then away you go. You just sit and wait.
Nice. Alan, what have you been doing?
I've been contributing my voice.
Oh, is this another home assistant?
Well, might end up being one, who knows. Mozilla Common Voice project, which has been around for a while. And you basically go to a website and some words appear on the screen and you read the words out and then you play them back to make sure you recorded them okay. And then you submit them. And they're building up this giant corpus of people with different accents from all around the world in different languages saying the same set of sentences. Mm-hmm. And then they use that for things. People can download the corpus of data, which is the text strings and the audio files. And they're enormous dumps of data. And then they can use them for, I don't know, machine learning, AI, you know, the next Mycroft or whatever it might be. I don't know. But the idea is that it allows people to do research into linguistics and language, but also gives them the flexibility of having lots of different people saying the same thing with different accents, with different background noise, you know, people with noise going hubbub going on in the background. They're not all perfectly recorded in recording studio perfect conditions, which is, you know, when people are shouting at lady cylinders and shouting at their phone, they're likely not doing it in perfect audio conditions. So
right.
that's the idea anyway.
Right. And there's sort of two sides to Common Voice, isn't there? There's people contributing their voice, and then there's also a side where you can listen to what people have said and check yes. that what they've said is actually what the text
said. Yeah, you verify.
Have you been doing that as well?
Yeah, you can do both. It's the same web page. You just flick between speak and listen. And if you get bored of speaking, you can switch to listen. And listen just gives you five in a row. It shows you the text on the screen. You hit the play button. And if the person says accurately what's on the screen, you say yes. And if they don't, you say no. And if they get enough people saying yes, then that gets added to the corpus. And if a few people say no, then that gets booted out and they take somebody else's recording. So yeah, it's really straightforward cool. and simple to use. And it's quite a nice way to pass the time and contribute to something that might be helpful in making further speech recognition things.
Nice.
And with that, let's get on with the rest of the show. Now, as we've got Reese on the show, we thought we'd have a chat to him about the Ubuntu community. So, Reese, your job title is Developer Advocate, is that correct?
That is quite correct, yes.
So let's start there. What does a Developer Advocate do?
A lot of times it depends on the company you work for, but the general rule of thumb is that a Developer Advocate is someone who represents a developer's interests and helps them use tools and products sort of more efficiently or in a nicer way. In Canonical for Ubuntu, that manifests itself in a generic Ubuntu sense, as in talking to people about Ubuntu, but a lot of Ubuntu users and developers are very mature. It's a very mature sort of product and platform. And so for me, it manifests in working with community developers, working with partners and organizations who have other communities or developers who want to work with Canonical or work with Ubuntu as an organization.
And you recently started working as part of the, or relatively recently, I should probably say, started working as part of the Ubuntu community team. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
So what does the community team do?
So the community team is almost an extension of what I just said. There are 2.5 of us now. There's myself, there's Monica, who's the community representative, and the half is Ken Van Dyne, who's our sort of interim community team manager while we find, while we look for someone new to lead it full time. We have split our roles into sort of three different types of things. There's interfacing with the community, which is a lot of Monica's doing. There's interfacing with organizations and partners, which is a lot of my doing. And then there's sort of community operations and working in discourse and working on how teams inside Canonical as well as projects in the Ubuntu community work, which we sort of share.
So it's fair to say this has been a bit of a reboot in the last year or so, I think. I know you were doing other things at Canonical before you worked on the community team. Was it your idea that you would move across and work on community? What was it that attracted you to it? Why did you want to do this rather than whatever else you were doing?
I did a little blog post about this some 6 months or something ago now, a little bit more than that, I guess, when I moved from a product management position at Canonical to a developer advocate position at Canonical. And what attracted me there was while I was doing product management stuff, I did a lot of work with the advocacy team. I did a lot of work with touching community work with a lot of different products. And I found that one of the things that I was good at and one of the things that I enjoyed, more importantly, was that kind of interface working with people, users of Ubuntu and the partners that we sort of have this collaborative relationship with, folks like, I say we, I mean Canonical, folks like Dell, Lenovo, Flutter from Google, Raspberry Pi, those kinds of folks. And so when I got tired of the product management thing, I was looking for something new, I was looking for new challenges. And so I was actually appointed at the community team by our benevolent dictator, by Mr. Mark Shuttleworth, who said, hey, you should go and try that thing. And I thought, oh yeah, that actually sounds like an interesting and good idea. And so I did.
It's a rather unique thing. Well, I don't know if it's unique, but it's certainly different about Canonical that people often move around from one role to another within the company. And I've not seen that a huge amount in other organizations I've worked for. You're hired into a role and you're there to do a specific job that role requires. And if that role is no longer required, you're redundant and you leave. Or if you get tired of the job, you leave. But Canonical, it's the case where you can you can say, actually, I'd quite like to go and work over there with that team, or there's a product over there that I have a keen interest in. And, you know, so long as it logistically works out and financially works out and, you know, nobody's left in the lurch, then it's an entirely plausible thing to do, right?
Definitely. And that's, I think that's one of the best things about Canonical is people recognize, if you're very good, people recognize you're very good. If you're doing something that you enjoy, people want you to keep doing something that you enjoy. And that's very important to sort of senior management, if you will. They want to make sure that if you're working at Canonical and you're good at what you're doing, they want to make sure that you enjoy what you're doing. And so if you would like to move around because you prefer to be working on something different, or maybe you've found passion for this, or maybe like me, you've sort of fallen off the train. That's not an expression, but you know what I mean?
Off the tracks, maybe? The wagon?
Yeah, that's the one. Falling off the train, off the wagon.
Who knows?
When you've fallen off some vehicle, they're happy for you to look around and see if you want to try something else.
So what's going on with the community team at the moment? What are your current sort of activities?
So this is the big question that I wanted to hear. So stop me if you have any questions or comments. I'm just going to go. So we've got a few things that we're doing right now that are ongoing. We've got the wallpaper competition for 2110 that closes. Oh, when does this go out? It might have already closed. In fact, it probably has already closed.
Well, you had it anyway. It is stroke was a thing.
It was a thing.
Well done to everyone who entered.
Yeah, well done to everyone who entered. Congratulations,
and especially
you winners.
To the winner.
What else is there?
Insert name here.
Exactly. We've been doing a lot of Ubuntu on Air things. I wrote a little blog post recently about what that means, what we've been doing, how things have been going. Ubuntu on Air, for those who don't know, is a community. Well, it will be a community-run YouTube channel. At the moment, it's myself and Monica, where we talk about Ubuntu things and have community guests on, which is going to be a lot of fun.
So when you say it will be community, does that mean it won't be necessarily you and Monica on there always? You could like pull in developers or community advocates and get them to talk about a subject they're passionate about, right?
Right. We want to take ourselves off the reins and hand things over. At the beginning, we knew we wouldn't be able to do that straight away because we wanted to find some structure, find our feet a little bit, get things going. But the intention is eventually we'll hand the keys to some trusted people in the community, and they'll be able to just stream or help other people stream as long as they go, which is the other thing that we've done recently, which is a call for content. And while this will be going out a little while after that post, it'll still be there. If you're a part of the Ubuntu community and you'd like to show off something, if you want to talk about something to the rest of the Ubuntu community, find that discourse thread on discourse.ubuntu.com. It's just called Call for Content in the community category, and let us know. And hopefully by this time when you're listening, we'll have something up there. We've got a couple of irons in the fire, and I'm excited to see where they go. Beyond that, we're also talking to a number of teams inside Canonical to get them doing more community things, doing sort of guidelines for working more in the open, guidelines for interacting with communities and encouraging that kind of culture. It's something that a lot of people in Canonical agree is something that we've been missing for a long time. So it's good to see that that's coming back.
Is that something you feel, I mean, partly because there was no community team for a long while, you know, people were reallocated to other things. So people just forgot about it and, you know, had other priorities, or there's no... And you just need to reboot. Is that the idea? You just want to get people remembering, hey, you know, you need to go back to doing this thing that was important and useful.
I think it's mostly that. It's a lot of people just, it just wasn't a priority, or it wasn't part of their directive. Not that it wasn't a priority, it just wasn't something they were told to do. And it was just something they were maybe expected to do, or people thought that they were doing. And then it just sort of fell to the wayside because there was no weight to it. But after a little while of that, everything sort of moved on. Tooling moved on, tools moved on, how things were done, processes moved on, and they moved in maybe more of an efficient way, but not more of a accessible way.
An open way, right.
Right. So it's in need of a reboot, but it's also in need of a bit of a gear switch, which is sort of our end goal as a team, myself and Monica, which is to make whatever small progress we make on the community team for the community, make it sustainable. So even if the community team does disappear, that there are processes in place, and I'm not saying it will, that there are processes in place to make sure that things persist.
Awesome. And you said you're hiring for a new team lead. Is that right? Is that public on the careers page if people are interested in any of the community team related roles?
Correct. There is a director of community role open on the Canonical careers page, canonical.com/careers. It'll be in there somewhere. And if it's not up yet, it should be. So I'm going to say it anyway. There's also should be a role for a developer operations role to join myself and Monica. It's a little bit different. It's sort of a cross between developer advocate and community representative. But the idea is we want someone with a bit of technical know-how, a bit of operational know-how to come in and help us and help the community get things done in a more process-orientated tooling way while abiding by this culture. So if, for example, a wonderful thread about a membership application comes up again, not only will we be able to respond to it and get things done in this kind of way, but we'll have someone that can support that initiative in a more hands-on, prototype-y sense.
Yeah, because the problem with stuff like that is, at the end of the day, someone actually needs to do some work to,
yes.
In a lot of cases, if there's, you know, if you want to implement a new process, someone has to actually write some code and do some configuration of services. And, you know, it's really, really positive that there's going to be like someone whose job it is to do that sort of thing.
Exactly.
The current state is everyone looks around at each other and says, yeah, that's a really interesting thing. We should totally do that. And then Nobody picks it up because everyone wants it, but nobody's responsible for it. So yeah, you need someone responsible.
The current state is we've got lots of sticks and we're trying to bash people with them. Whereas we'd like someone to just go in and do things.
To be the person you can bash with the sticks. Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah. So if our listeners are listening to this and think, oh, this sounds interesting, I'd like to be involved in this. How can they get involved in the community and the community team's activities?
Well, if they want to get involved in the community, specifically, I think the best place to start to have a poke around is the Ubuntu Discourse. Again, discourse.ubuntu.com, where you can see what's going on. It's the sort of, I like to describe it as the town hall of the community. If the community was a physical place, you could see sort of things. It's sort of like a notice board. Mm-hmm. But from there, you'll be able to find what you're interested in. Maybe there's a project going on. Maybe there's a small team or a project that's happening that you can get involved in or poke around in. If you want to interact with myself or Monica and the community team, you can find us in the community category or ping us individually. You'll be able to find us pretty easily, I hope, where you can ask us questions. Or if you have an idea or something that you want to do, either just do it and let us know after the fact or ask us if it's something that we can help with, and we will.
Excellent.
Thanks very much for that, Reese. We should get you back on to talk more about this in a future episode. And now it's time for command line love. And I'm providing the command line love this week. So I have come across a problem multiple times. I don't know if this is because I'm running Bash on Windows or if this is also a problem on Linux, but I've not noticed it as much before. But what I often find is I have multiple Bash windows open and I'm doing stuff, and then I turn off my computer and I come back the next day and I scroll back through my history and it's not there. And what's happened is I haven't actually exited any of the shells. They've just been killed and it's not written the history file, or it's not rereading the history file, or something's gone wrong. So I found a little command which makes it so that every time that you run a command, it then appends your current history to the history file and rereads it. And what that means is if you've got lots of shells open, they all know about each other's history and it gets automatically updated each time you run a command. So I've stuck this in the show notes and it's made my life a lot better.
I did not know this was a thing I needed. This is a thing I needed. I have the same problem, but not in Bash on Windows. For years, I've thought, I'm sure I typed something to do with this. And I do Control R the next day. And I'm like, where on earth did that go? I definitely typed something with that worded. And I didn't realize that there's some reason why it, whatever you've typed doesn't go into the Bash history. And I don't understand why. I wish it did.
As I understand it, by default, what happens is when you exit a shell, then it writes your history from that session to the history file. And then when you start a new shell, it reads that history file, and that's what you can scroll back through. But this makes it so that each time you run a command, it writes and rereads the file, which is much better.
I shall have to give this a go. Thank you. It'll be in the show notes, I guess.
It will.
Under Love.
File this under Love. That's the name of my jazz album. And now it's time for all your wonderful, wonderful feedback. And Brian Roden emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
Bought an Epson refillable printer several years ago when it first came out. I printed 5,607 pages and have used less than 3/4 of the 2 sets of bottles it came with. Plus, when I actually need to get my 3rd set of bottles, it will cost me about $80 for another 3,000 to 4,000 pages. I spent probably $600 to $700 on ink on my old Canon printer before it broke down on me, and I'm sure I didn't print half as many pages as this Epson. I get 10 times as much printing for the same price out of my Epson. Well, there's a ringing endorsement for Epson printers, I believe.
Yes.
Sorry for giggling when you said how many pages, but it just seemed weird that someone would know exactly how many pages. I appreciate the printer probably told you this, but it just makes me chuckle that someone knows how many pages exactly. That their printer has printed. Thank you for that, Brian.
Jason Armstrong emailed,
I literally use Firefox because my wife uses Chrome. Nary the two shall mix when we are using the same central computer, like his and hers towels. I've tried Vivaldi and enjoyed the ease of theming, the built-in notes-taking capabilities on the sidebar and the baked-in email client. I've never been a fan of Safari. Not much luck with Epiphany either. I totally understand why Elementary OS includes Epiphany as default, but I always swap it out for Firefox the moment I install.
I'd completely forgotten that the whole concept of two people using one account on one computer was a thing. I haven't done that ever. That's a lie. The last time two people in my house shared the same computer account was in 1997, and it was me and my wife had Windows 98 or something on a computer. Ever since then, everyone's had their own accounts.
I'll be honest, I didn't really understand what I was saying, and that clears it up. And wow.
I think the point is that, like, he has a browser icon and she has a browser icon.
It makes a lot more
sense.
They're
two different things, yeah. Wow.
Edward Ross emailed,
I'm just resigned to being part of the Google matrix, so use Chrome everywhere. However, I keep Firefox around for one unique feature, which is Control-Click for cell selection in tables, apparently. If Chrome did that too, I'd not need any other browser.
Wow, I didn't know that was a thing in Firefox, even though I use it. So there you go. George Coffrey mailed with a command line love.
Regarding your discussion of erasing data from drives and such, I was surprised you didn't mention the shred command. It can write random data or just zeros as many times as you want to disks, partitions, or files. I generally use it to write zeros or one level of random data, then zeros to drives to erase them. But you can write as many levels of random data as your paranoia desires.
Yeah, we talked about some ludicrous shell scripts that I use to delete data, well, to fill up a disk and then delete the data afterwards. It is mental, I know. I should just use these commands like shred, but I quite like actually exercising the drive like this.
And finally, David emailed.
You asked about the web browsers we use. I like to use Edbrowse. When I find websites where Edbrowse does not work, I use Mozilla Firefox. Edbrowse makes it easy for me to use script common tasks. Do you ever need to use a command line browser? I've never heard of Edbrowse.
No, this is a command line web browser that uses an interface similar to Ed, the editor. Of your... I don't ever use a command line browser. I occasionally use command line HTTP clients like GET and CURL, mainly to test, can I access this file on this server and things like that. But no, I never actually do any browsing in the terminal.
I have a laptop which is command line only, has no GUI, and I have used links on it to search for stuff and log into pages and stuff like that, but not like aggressively using the command line only in order to browse the web.
Can you think of any reason that you would need to use a command line browser?
I used to work in a data center, and the only computers within like 30 feet of me were servers that had no GUI interface, and smartphones weren't a thing. In fact, we weren't even allowed phones in the building. So standing in a data center where the only thing you have is a terminal, Lynx is the best when you have no other browser. Lynx is the best browser. Or maybe Edbrowse is the best browser. I've never even heard of Edbrowse before today. So thank you, David, for enlightening me that there are other terminal-based browsers.
And that's all of your feedback for this week. And that's all for episode 24. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.